It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the head of a homeless shelter in Madison about what resources are available for homeless people in the bitter cold.
First, Assembly Republicans were considering new rules that would have made it easier to cut off debate in the Assembly. Republicans have a majority in the Assembly, and these rules could have allowed them to shut down debate by minority Democrats.
Sean Johnson is here to give us the latest. He's WPR's state government reporter. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this story, a moving target today. What is the latest on these proposed rule changes?
So they approved the rule changes, but they are definitely scaled back from what Republicans first floated late last week. They would still require the minority leader and the majority leader to agree to time limits to discuss bills on the assembly floor. And, you know, before last session, that would have been unheard of. I mean, assembly lawmakers kind of felt like it was their right to speak as long as they wanted to on any issue of the day. And sometimes they did. We'd have overnight sessions in the debate over Act 10. The debate, you know, really literally lasted about 3 days, just around the clock. So, I mean, there's a history of where debates would go a very long time in the assembly. Last session, Republican Speaker Robin Voss and Assembly Democratic Minority Leader Peter Barkas said they wanted to kind of calm things down a bit. They reached basically a gentleman's agreement that said, we're going to come up with time limits, reasonable time limits we can both agree upon before every assembly session. And last session, they abided by that. What the rule change that they voted on today would do is essentially codify what was previously a gentleman's agreement. What it does not do is it does not include language that would let majority Republicans cut off debate after a minimum of a half hour, which was a possibility in the rules that were first released last week.
That was one of the ideas being considered. What was the reaction to that more, I think it'd be fair to say, stringent option?
You know, I didn't hear like a real big freak out from Democrats over these rules. The Republicans floated them out there, and they've been meeting with Democrats discussing them in recent days. You know, I mean, Republicans have a huge majority in the assembly. They can do what they want on policy matters. And so really when it comes to what Democrats can do, I mean, their voice is what they still have. They can stand up on the assembly floor and complain loudly about bills that they don't like, and they can complain at length. And so when you start talking about time limits, you're talking about taking that away. But, really, Speaker Voss and Minority Leader Peter Barkas have had a pretty good relationship when it comes to this stuff. I mean, Voss is definitely steering the ship when it comes to imposing time limits. When you come down to it, there's really little that Barkas can do to stop him. But they have at least kind of worked in concert on this stuff.
Now, this sounds kind of procedural now, but as you're saying, back in the days of Act 10, issues over who got to speak, when, how long, got pretty heated, didn't they?
Very heated, yeah. I mean, that was a 3-day debate. People were exhausted by the end, and, you know, that probably is part of the reason that debate went the way that it did. I mean, it was eventually, it's hard to say that a debate was cut off abruptly when it lasted a few days, but eventually, Republicans just decided they'd had enough, and they called the question. They called for the vote. Democrats who were in the chamber at the time gathered around and pointed fingers and shouted shame at Republicans. The gallery went nuts. It's a totally different atmosphere today, though. I mean, at least the two assembly galleries that I could see from where I was sitting were completely empty. It was just, nobody raised their voice in the assembly. Some of the hyperbole that you'll hear in your average session day was largely absent. But, you know, if we have a big proposal like, let's say, I don't know, right to work has been thrown around there, all that could change and time to speak on an issue could be, you know, at a premium.
Now, this is just a chamber of the legislature setting its own rules. This isn't something that is a state law that they need to pass and get signed by the governor and so on.
Exactly. They set their own rules. They always have. So this is something that they'll abide by. The Senate is not bound by such rules. They, you know, when it comes to time limits, I've never heard it discussed over there. They basically kind of talk themselves out on issues. There's fewer of them. Everybody gets a chance to say their piece, and you know, they're usually ready to go home by the time everybody's had a chance to talk.
And we're not hearing anything about rule changes like this in the Senate, are we?
No, not like this. I mean, you know, this wasn't the only rule that they adopted. In fact, they took some of the Senate's language out of their rules on what it means to meet in partisan caucuses, which essentially lets them get around the open meetings law a little bit, and it will let the leaders like Representative Barca and Representative Voss meet privately with others to discuss things like assembly rule changes. So, the chambers will give and take on rules when they find something to their liking, but I haven't heard the Senate talking about any kind of time limits like this.
Well, ultimately, however long people are able to talk on issues, Republicans are going to have the votes they need to pass what they want, by and large.
Yeah, absolutely. They have the biggest majority they've had in that chamber since the 1950s. I mean, they had a big majority before. They maintained that big majority in 2012 in what was, not a huge Democratic wave year in Wisconsin, but a Democratic year. Barack Obama won, Tammy Baldwin won, but Republicans held on to their seats, and in this past election cycle, they gained a few more. It was a Republican year. They did benefit, certainly, from a Republican-drawn legislative map, but they have the numbers that they need to set the agenda. As I say, sometimes all a Democrat can do is get up and talk.
Well, getting into some of what's on that agenda, one of the first items you're hearing about, actually on both sides of the legislature, school accountability, changing the way that works. What are we hearing today on that?
The school accountability is one of those issues that's been talked about in the Capitol for a few years now. And I'm talked about by the governor for a few years. He said that he wants all schools who take public dollars, whether they are private voucher schools or traditional public schools or charter schools, they want them to be held accountable. And it's just been tricky to get lawmakers, even though the legislature has been under Republican control, they have not agreed on what that means. And so what you saw today is Assembly Republicans coming out with what they think that should mean. And it's pretty interesting stuff in there. One of the things that they're proposing is that if they would create this new A through F grading system for public schools, which is something that hasn't actually been talked about before. And if a school fails for, I think, 3 years of testing, gets a D or F after 3 years of testing, they have to take over. They have to implement this school improvement plan. If after another 4 years they're still failing, they would be, by state law, they would be required to be turned into a charter school. That's a big step. And, you know, you're talking about one of the reasons this bill hasn't passed in previous sessions is that some lawmakers, when they start to look at what the bill would mean for their schools, they see it's punitive. It could hurt schools in their district. This is definitely a punitive bill by nature. You know, whether or not that hurts its chances of passage this session, we'll see. It's a completely different legislature.
And that's on the Assembly side. One of the leading voices in the Senate, Republican Senate State Senator Paul Farrow, has been a big advocate for school accountability. Have his plans looked anything like this? Does he have this kind of punitive angle in what he's looking for?
He has not said that he's going to support this bill right out of the gate. Actually, there was another draft of this bill that was released earlier this morning, not circulated, and it's no longer part of what they're talking about now. But early on, there was talk about penalizing school administrators in districts that are failing. So the Senate's working on their own bill. Whether or not it includes some elements of the Assembly bill, we'll see. It's a conservative legislature in that body too. But the State Assembly, I think just maybe by the way that it's run by Speaker Voss is going to probably take the lead on a lot of issues and try to get out in front on a lot of issues this session. And so they kind of came out right out of the gate with this one. Should mention also that that assembly version would allow for schools to take different tests, private schools to take different tests potentially than public schools as they measure up on this A through F grading system.
Sean, this session's just getting rolling. You're Mr. Prime Time. Are you ready to rock on all this stuff?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Let's go.
All right, Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Government Reporter, with us to talk about some of the early action in the State Assembly.
We're talking about a particularly vulnerable population in Wisconsin right now, homeless people. While the bitterly cold temperatures sweeping the state this week are challenging for a lot of people, this weather is especially hard on those who don't have a home.
Here to talk about what resources are available for the homeless, we have Stephen Schooler with us. He's Executive Director for Porchlight in Madison. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So can you just paint a general picture? How do homeless people deal with just bitterly cold temperatures like we're seeing this last couple of days?
It's obviously very, very challenging. The one thing in terms of the Madison area, the one thing that is good is that there are a number of different places where they can go, both during the day and during the evening hours. We have a number of facilities in downtown Madison, which is where most of the homeless folks are located. We have the downtown central library, which is open daily from 9 to 9. We have a church, Bethel Lutheran Church, that is providing services to those folks. There also is a van service that Dane County provides that provides funding for that we operate that basically drives folks from certain places in the downtown area amongst other places of where they can get resources to a daytime resource center on Martin Street, to a job center, to a program that we operate for persons with serious mental illness. So the basic strategy is to offer a number of different opportunities for people to get inside and encourage them to get inside and stay inside.
Now, for you and your colleagues in similar agencies around the state, is this kind of crunch time for you? You're swinging into high gear, all hands on deck, to try to find warm, safe places?
Sure. Not only is it making sure that the warm, safe places exist and making sure that our operations exist. The numbers, of course, are very, very high during the winter months. In terms of staying in the shelter, we were serving 150 to 160 men a night, any given night, in our shelters. On top of that, the other challenge, and this is a challenge for the community, and it's a challenge that goes beyond just Porchlight or service agencies. It's a challenge for the police, the sheriff's department, and that is making sure that everybody has an opportunity to get inside, and that is encouraged to get inside. And quite frankly, there are some individuals that are very, very service-resistant, shelter institution-resistant, and the real challenge is to try and overcome that resistance and get them inside.
Now, this is a moment when everybody's scrambling around the state. Big picture, are there things that you'd like to see maybe at local government levels or even the state level to be more prepared for moments like this?
Well, there are certainly several different things that could assist. I mean, one of the issues has been in Dane County is having a daytime resource center, and that has been an ongoing battle for now two or three different years. And we've had a couple of different facilities in a couple of different places. But getting that set up and getting that organized in such a way where it can serve a number of different people with a number of different resources would certainly be helpful, and that's in process. And I think that's true for other communities as well throughout the state, having some place, particularly in the wintertime, where people can go during the day and be safe. And at the same time, here's an opportunity, too. During the winter months, there may be more of an incentive to really, really focus in on the issues that cause one to be homeless in the first place and to get them to access, persuade them to access services. So having that opportunity to access services, using the cold, in a sense, as a positive to try and encourage people to get services is really, really important.
So are you able to get service providers in, say, the shelters or the daytime resource centers to maybe make that first contact with a homeless person?
Sure. I mean, in Madison, we have several different agencies, including Porchlight, that have outreach workers that are actually working with folks both on the streets and in these various facilities. We have outreach workers at the Downtown Central Library. And those aren't just Porchlight outreach workers, but they're outreach workers from a number of different agencies. There is, at Bethel Lutheran Church, outreach services that are provided. At the Daytime Resource Center, their outreach. So the outreach services are available. To be honest, it's a little bit harder on the outreach workers to get out there and get to the people during this cold winter time and make access with them out on the streets. But still, that does happen.
Now, you talked some about the nighttime shelters. I mean, how long is that a resource in terms of, you know, the daily clock for
Correct.
People?
Yes. So during the winter time, we open up earlier. Typically, our typical hours of operation are 8 to 8 o'clock to around 7, 8 o'clock at night to around 7 in the morning. In the winter time, we open up several hours earlier at 5 o'clock so that people can get in earlier and have a place to stay. In addition, beyond that, if there is really cold weather like the past couple nights and tomorrow and maybe even beyond that, we will keep the shelter open later on into the day until 9 o'clock when the library opens. And that's true for the other shelter service providers like the Salvation Army and Madison, too. They will stay open extra hours to make sure that people always have a place to be.
Now, how about
that is inside.
How about things like winter wear? Is there help getting coats, hats, gloves,
yeah.
that sort of thing?
I mean,
thing?
Sure. Donations of that kind of stuff, particularly, not the stuff that people want to throw away, to be honest with you, but mm-hmm. the stuff that is reasonably good, particularly gloves and hats and coats, can be utilized. The Salvation Army, does take those. We take those. Those are helpful. Socks and warm winter boots. Again, the sizes, people wonder about the size. The sizes are large, extra large. Those are the sizes. Medium and small don't, for the most part, work.
Now, this cold comes at a time where we're already experiencing in the state high levels of influenza, epidemic in
right.
the country, a lot of flu in Wisconsin. For somebody who's homeless, what kind of health care options are there to seek out?
Well, to be honest with you, for the homeless, we've made quite an effort to get people signed up for Medicaid and where appropriate for the Affordable Care Act. So a lot of these folks, unless they're very service resistant, do have access to medical resources under that. Getting them to access those resources is important. If someone were to come down with a flu or influenza, there's no question in my mind that we couldn't get them to a hospital and get them taken care of in Madison. The ongoing issue and the challenge has been, and this year has been an odd year, so we always make a tremendous effort to get people vaccinated. And again, I can't overemphasize the importance of vaccinations. Unfortunately, this year, the vaccinations, it doesn't appear, have been very good because they didn't hit the right flu strain. Nevertheless, we do that. We also have separate rooms in our facilities. If someone is sick, of course, if it's a serious flu thing, we would send them to the hospital. But if someone is sick, we have separate facilities as well to serve those. And finally, we do have actually medic clinics. The University of Wisconsin Medical School has medical students that actually come and serve at the shelter once every couple weeks to see people.
Now, people around the state are listening, and some might be thinking, gosh, I'd like to do something to help out. What kind of help is useful to a service provider like yours?
Well, at this time, obviously, I mean, we're getting crunched in terms of resources, so funding is important. We have a website. The Salvation Army has a website. People can go onto those websites and donate directly. That's in one sense, an easy answer, and it provides, you know, resources that we really, really need. Other things, though, I mean, donations of, you know, gloves, caps, socks, warm socks, that sort of thing is certainly helpful. In terms of volunteer activities at this point, there are some volunteer groups in Madison, and you can get connected with those through the Homeless Services Consortium that actually do work out on the streets. It's not for the faint of heart, but do work on the streets and help with getting people into shelter.
As we wrap up, the cold thankfully will end, but what would be a top priority in dealing with homelessness in the community that you'd like to see people tackle even after we're not worried about this bitter cold?
Well, the top priority, the reason why people are homeless is because they don't have homes. And the reason why they don't have homes is because the housing that is affordable with the services that people need does not exist. That's what we need. It's a long-term, it's not an easy fix, but that is the fix.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Schooler, Executive Director for Porch Light in Madison. He joined us here today to talk about resources available for homeless people in the bitter cold. That's Madison specific. If you've got something going on in your area, we'd love to hear about it. Send us a note. Tell us what community services are available in your part of the state. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we find out why those going to meetings, responding on that email, might be killing your productivity at work.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. The Wabigan Bar in Superior is firmly in Wisconsin, but you can only get there from Minnesota. Rich Kramer went to visit this bar with two zip codes.
You have to keep reminding yourself that the Wabigan Bar and Supper Club is a Wisconsin establishment. It's in the town of Superior, in Douglas County, Wisconsin. Even so, every license plate in the parking lot is blue and white, each bragging about 10,000 lakes. And quite frankly, in nearly every way, the Wabigan feels Minnesotan through and through. Maybe that's because no matter how you try, you can't get there unless you cross the border and drive more than 4 miles through Minnesota. Douglas County Administrator Andy Leshak says when Wisconsin was formed, the St. Louis River was used as a starting point for the northwestern border. He says a thin finger of the Badger State stabs northward into Minnesota. It's mostly dense, hilly forest, and the only highway that passes through is Minnesota State 23.
It just doesn't seem logical that you'd have to go on a Minnesota highway to get to Wisconsin property, that you can't get there from here using Wisconsin roads.
Paul Vernon is the owner of the Wabigan, which was built in 1932. He says the state line actually cuts through his driveway.
If you pull out of my driveway here, you hit two different counties in two different states. You pull out, you go to the left, you're in Carlton County, Renshaw, Minnesota. If you turn right, you're in Douglas County, Superior, Wisconsin.
Having a Wisconsin bar on the border has its advantages, says Vernon, as he looks to a long line of beer coolers and a rack of liquor bottles for sale.
We can sell off sale 365 days a year. Minnesota, you can't sell on Sundays, you can't sell on Christmas, you can't sell on Thanksgiving. We can. The vast majority of our off-sale that we do is on Sundays. Probably about 70% of it happens on Sundays.
Another telltale sign that the Wabigan is actually in Wisconsin is the line of five video slot machines against the wall. But when it comes to sports, Vernon says it's all Minnesota.
We're a Vikings bar. We're not a Packers bar. We're a Twins bar. We're not a Brewers bar.
But Vernon says getting the Minnesota sports package on satellite TV can be tricky.
Our zip code's Wisconsin, 54880. But if you want Vikings games, you want Twins games, you have to lie and give them a Duluth zip code because they won't give you it. They send you to the Packers and the Brewers. So I can't put a Packer game on. They'll hang me. So I guess, you know, it comes down to life and limb.
Carol and Phil Hobner have a cabin near the Wabigan. It's a place they call no man's land because of the strange border and the rustic woods. Phil says in their youth they'd take advantage of the Wabigan's location when Wisconsin's drinking age was 18 and Minnesota's was 21.
We used to come here when we were in college because you could go from Minnesota into Wisconsin, have a beer, and then you'd dip back into Minnesota without getting into any trouble.
Though the great majority of Wabigan patrons are Minnesotans, George Houle of the nearby city of Renshaw says Wisconsinites do pass through, but they know their place.
There's a lot of people from Wisconsin that drink here, too, with us, you know, and I think they realize that it's more a Minnesota bar than a Wisconsin bar, you know, and they don't argue with us about it.
Back in Superior, County Administrator Leshak says whether they call the Wabigan a Minnesota bar or a Wisconsin bar doesn't really matter. He says what's important is the half a cent the county gets from every dollar spent there.
So we encourage our friends in Minnesota to visit the Wabigan and be great patrons of the Wabigan.
It really is.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Do you ever feel like you ought to be getting more done at work? Well, maybe it's not you. New data gathering tools are helping employers pinpoint where all the time goes. Turns out responding to email and attending meetings are two chief culprits.
What's more, a lot of those emails or meetings requests seem to come from just a handful of people in an organization. And once those people are identified, they can start dialing it down, hopefully, so people who work with them can get more done.
Sue Schellenbarger joins us now. She writes the Work and Family column at the Wall Street Journal. Sue, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Well, there's a common feeling at work that maybe we should be getting more done, maybe a sense that it could be the email, could be the meetings, but you're writing about new tools that actually help us figure it out, figure out where those culprits are.
There are new data gathering tools that are for the first time applying algorithms to employees' email headers and subject lines to figure out who's communicating with who. They're also looking at online calendars, such as Outlook, who's scheduling meetings with whom, who's attending. And it's not an invasion of privacy. The data about personal activity is stripped out before it's given to the employer. But what it does do is help identify groups that are meeting more than others, groups that are spending way too many time in meetings, too much time in meetings. And on a confidential level, individual employees can get reports on their own time use and find out how they compare to their colleagues in terms of calling meetings, sending emails, and burdening others with all of those extra work.
In terms of the people that you looked at, some companies have done some of these studies and you wrote about them. What did you find about just how much time burden can be placed on people because of these emails and meetings?
It can be huge. Volumetrics is the data analysis company that was hired by Seagate, and Boeing has a pilot going, and some others. And at some companies, there are a small handful of people who are really off the charts. They consume more than 400 hours a week of colleagues' time, not at those two companies, but in general. And if that's the equivalent of 10 people working full-time every week just to read one manager's email and attend that manager's meeting, there are habits that managers fall into of inviting a lot of people to meetings so they don't offend anyone, or hitting reply all, or sending out a lot of batch emails, or answering emails that don't need to be answered. All of these are habits maybe started for sort of good reasons, but they wind up being a time sink for large groups.
And maybe the people doing that sort of thing are thinking about how important they are as they convene these important meetings and send out, get everybody on board in these big emails.
Well, you put your finger right on it. It's that they take their eye off the ball. In those cases, it's ego or some kind of idea about being polite or not offending people that's operating when they're really not thinking that time is money inside the corporation. And at first, some of these executives are kind of like proud of, you know, how grueling their lives are, but after they realize they're maybe costing hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of a year, they're willing to change their ways.
So what is just a few of these super senders, just to look at email now? What are some of the cardinal mistakes people make when they do send out massive volumes of email?
Sometimes everybody doesn't need to see that email. It turns it into a spectator sport. Seagate, which is a company that's used the volumetrics technology, so that, you know, we really don't need spectators on email. Just send it to the people who absolutely need to know. And avoid reply all like the plague. Unless you've got a reply all that really is going to change the lives of the people who receive that email, don't hit reply all just to clue them in or just say, yay, I'll be there. You bet. You know, you don't need those. We sometimes get hundreds of them, even inside our own newsroom. Vague subject lines can cause people to, you know, read emails they don't need to read. Just basically unclear email that forces people to read without really understanding the point.
And how about, is there a problem of trying to accomplish too much within an email, too many different, separate, coherent points?
Really, few people will read beyond one or two paragraphs. Some people also fall into the trap of trying to work out disagreements on email. If you've ever tried to do that, it's the worst way. You can take a simple little spat and extend it into World War III over, you know, several dozen emails going back and forth, getting angrier and angrier. And another confusing point is people have big egos. They think, oh, I've got all this email. I'm so overloaded. Another sort of sign of corporate machismo that really ought to be a thing of the past by now.
Well, we're talking right now with Sue Schellenbarger. She writes a Work and Family column for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about why emails and meetings can sink our productivity at work and what to do about it. We're talking with Sue Schellenbarger. She writes the work and family column for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about why email and meetings can really drain our productivity at work.
Yeah, new measurement techniques show that email meetings we don't need to be at can absorb a lot of our time. And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your workday slips away without getting much done because you're having to deal with this email from that boss, go to the meeting called by that other boss that you didn't need to be at the first in the first place? Or maybe you a culprit. You send out too many emails, copy too many people, take up their valuable time, call meetings that nobody wanted to go to anyway. Share your stories. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Rich with us from Genoa City. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just thought I would relay one of the reasons why I retired from teaching. One of the annoyances, I should say. It's not the reason, but I'm an old guy, obviously, if I retired, but we would get so many emails, and the teachers still complain about it. We get so many emails from parents that want to micromanage their kids, and I'm all for parental involvement, but when they ask for a detailed explanation, very often, very frequently, and, you know, a teacher gets 30 emails in a day, replying to 30 emails in an intelligent, coherent way. So it sounds like you know something that you do know, but you just have to write it all. That's a time, that really is a time drainer. And there's these other things we have to do as teachers. What do they call it? Teaching and grading and dealing with students.
Not so much the email all the time. Well, thank you, Rich. Appreciate that. And, you know, email does make it easy, maybe sometimes too easy to communicate with people. Do we over rely on email in general, do you think, Sue?
We do. I think it's a blessing and a curse. Many of us know we can work much faster via email, but it does give access really horizontally across the company and outside the company to many, many more people. And it's really easy to fall into a habit of over-communicating on email. You feel kind of like you're working, but if you really were analyze the email, is that necessary for my work, my job goals, my job description? A lot of times it's not. And poor Rich, I mean, he's a classic example of where your efforts just get splintered until you spend half your day on email and you haven't even started your real job. That was the case for some of the employees studied in some of the companies I looked at, where almost half their work week was gone and emails they didn't have to answer, meetings they shouldn't have been in.
Now, as a teacher, you feel kind of obliged to reply to the parent, but within a workplace, are we starting to move out of the mentality that all emails deserve a reply and are entitled to a reply?
You know, that's a really good question. Bain and Company, which did some studies in conjunction with the Volumetrics data gathering, has been training people. You don't have to reply to every email. You know, you just don't reply. And if your colleague objects or says they're hurt feelings, just say, you know, I'm really saving you time. That's another email you don't have to answer. It can be a cultural change. I've been trying to do this myself by curbing the impulse to just shoot back a thank you or a wow, I really appreciate knowing that. Just, you know, try not to expect a reply and you can streamline your day.
Well, we'll go back to our phone lines now. Rick is joining us from Baraboo. Hi, Rick.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I just was going to relay a story. I work for a company that has roughly 68,000 people in it. And somehow one morning sent an email out to a very large group. We're not even sure how it could happen, but they did. And then in turn, I mean, we have employees in all a lot of different countries. And then everyone began replying and asking why they received that email and sending it and replying to all. And then other people began replying to those people asking why they replied to all. It went on for 3 hours.
Wow.
One morning, and it was pretty hilarious.
Was it kind of fun or was it just a drag?
No, it was fun because I did not reply to any of them. I just sat and watched it, you know, go back and forth. But it was just kind of hilarious. People don't really understand, you know, the whole story and the whole. It was funny.
Right. Well, thanks a lot.
That and people that reply and say thank you.
Right.
I mean, it's real polite and everything, but there's just one more email for me to have to delete.
All right, they're being polite, and we talked about being polite being one of the last things maybe we need to let go of when it comes to email. So, Sue, with something like that, 68,000 people in Rick's company, I can't imagine what his inbox must have looked like. You can just sit there hitting delete over and over.
You know, we communicate for a living at the Wall Street Journal, and we do the same things. There was one long string where people really were really getting enraged because we work on email a lot, and the endless reply alls, and finally the most famous one was, you know, will you stop hitting reply all? And this person hit reply all. So, you know, it's like it's really like a virus. You just can't stop. Great story from Rick.
Thanks, Rick, for that call at 800-642-1234. That's the kind of thing that could bring a server to its knees and drive IT people crazy. Back to our callers now. We've got Tim on the line in Green Bay. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Do you have an email story or a meeting story?
I'm a teacher, and some of the other educators are calling in and saying to reply. A lot of these emails are very long. Number one, you never find out what they want because it's buried somewhere in, you know, three paragraphs. And this goes for anybody writing an email. What do you need? What is this email about, and why does it apply to you? If they put that up front, a lot of times you can tell I need to reply to this right away or not at all. The other thing is, and with parents and coworkers, model brevity. They might send you a page to read. And again, it's buried somewhere in there as to what they want you to do. I always model that back by saying, tell me what you want me to do about this, and I will do it. Or with parents, better to have a phone call or come on in. But again, model brevity in your emails. You should be able to put out an email in, I would say, a paragraph or less if there's some action to be taken on it, rather than to go on and give them every bit of information that maybe they don't have to know, or maybe they didn't even know one part of it. So model brevity in writing them.
Okay, so some good tools there, Tim, saying be the emailer you want to see in the world, and hopefully other people will follow suit. Does that work, Sue?
That's a very good, very, very good suggestion, and I think it does. I know it works for me. I am writing shorter emails because more of the people I write to are writing shorter emails. I don't expect an answer because more people I write to don't answer me. I think there's a lot to be done. Some people are incorrigible, however, and, you know, maybe they need training. In one case in my story, I interviewed a woman who coached a guy who just wrote these endless emails answering questions that, you know, nobody wanted answered, and she forced him to start writing only very brief answers to emails, and he was astonished when nobody asked for more information. So you really have to retrain people one by one, and I think hopefully that will happen as younger generations, you know, become more numerous in the workplace.
Tim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We've spent a lot of time on the email side of things. A little more on meetings, Sue. How do we make meetings more efficient, make sure they only involve the people who actually need to be there?
Boy, these are really problematic. People have gotten into the habit of asking more people rather than fewer to avoid offending anyone for being left out. And you see so many meetings where half the heads are dropped looking into the smartphones or, you know, working on a tablet while they're in the meeting, which is a dead giveaway that they don't need to be there. I think two things have to happen. Meetings have to be smaller. Bain & Company recommends 7 or fewer people in a meeting for optimal productivity. And second, you don't have to stay for the whole meeting. You know, maybe issue agendas that have just part of a team there when needed, so you're not sitting and listening to stuff you don't need to know. Meetings are a really dangerous time sink. I think most executives agree on this, and there's a lot to be done yet in this area.
Great. Well, let's go back to our callers now. Jan is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Jan.
Hi. We do haikus. Those are our emails. Our rule is if you can't say it in a haiku, you can't say it.
So 575 syllables there. Does that really work?
It does.
Wow.
It forces you to be real, not just brief, but pithy.
Can you read us one?
And everybody laughs. I mean, that's the thing. You have to really think before you press send.
Is there one that you can think of?
Oh, not offhand, but I will write after I hang up.
Okay, let us know. Maybe we'll give it a read on the air if it's interesting. Well, Jan, thanks a lot for that haikus. That's really taking it to a new level, Sue.
That would certainly slow a lot of people down, the non-poetic ones in the group, wouldn't it? They wouldn't write at all.
We've got to impose that here. I'll call a meeting. Eric, next in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hello, yes. My name is Eric. I'm from Milwaukee. Thank you for taking my call. My case is essentially being part of an email conversation or project initiation, and you essentially realize, you know, in the middle of the project that you are obviously not needed in the specific project or conversation, but you are included on every single email for the life of that project. Two, 3 years, and I know.
That's a classic problem. And, you know, why does that happen? I think people create these batch address groups and don't edit them. You know, that's one of the things that the trainers at Bain were saying, you know, just don't use those. You know, take the extra time to, you know, the extra 30 seconds to take out the names you don't need, and you'll save hours, countless hours upon hours of all those other people reading or maybe even attending the meetings.
Time for one more quick call. Krista joins us next in Wausau. Hi, Krista.
Hello. I just like to share with you that I'm trying to start a new trend. I usually, in my subject line, if I want to write a short answer, I just write NNTO, which stands for no need to open. And then I'll just write thanks or 6 p.m. or some short answer that they don't have to open the entire email to get my message. And that just saves them a little bit of time.
Cool. Well, you just invented a new code. I do that sometimes too, but then probably people click to see if there's more. But if I had the NNTO, people would not do that. That's very good.
Yeah, what are you trying to hide in that email, Veronica?
You'll never know.
Well, in effect, that's using the subject line like texting, but in your email.
Right.
Exactly. Very smart.
So, Sue, are we moving in a better direction based on some of this new research? Are we going to fix some of these problems?
Boy, it's varying company by company. This is a place, I think, where employers are truly all over the map. You can find some that are just as efficient as, and they run so smoothly on company wikis with project management tools where, you know, everybody works together collaboratively. And you've got the others that are still in fiefdoms where the emails and the meetings grind on and on. We're all over the map. I do think the progress is happening, though. I think people are much more mindful of the waste than they were in the past.
Well, interesting stuff. We'll see if we see some change in Wisconsin businesses, maybe here at WPR, too. Rob, I'm not pointing fingers, but Rob. Sue, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Sue Schellenberger writes the Work and Family column for The Wall Street Journal.